Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to this Wednesday's edition of Africa Link. I'm Eunice Wanjiru in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Oli Tangen Jr. and I will be covering what's trending on social media.
Coming up, communication and work has been paralyzed in English-speaking Cameroon after the government imposed an internet blackout.
People who used to rely solely on the internet to keep bread on their table have not been able to work, which means that the youth who are actively involved in this sector have gradually been laid off from their jobs. It's really terrible.
And in Somalia, dozens are reported to have died in a twin bombing near a hotel in the capital, Mogadishu.
Currently, the situation is calm. Basically, after the incident, after an hour, the situation went back to normal. So many people have been wounded.
And we will be bringing you lots of comments from social media on the situation in Cameroon.
But first, we find out what's been happening around the globe.
I'm Christina Kripal with the DW News. Global corruption increased last year, especially in the public sector, the Berlin-based anti-corruption watchdog Transparency International announced. According to the non-governmental organization's 2016 Corruption Perception Index, released on Wednesday, more countries saw the situation worsen than getting better. Regarding corruption in Africa, Samuel Kaninda, Transparency International's regional advisor for that continent, told DW,
"The average score for Africa remains quite below average, which points to systemic corruption. So you have the likes of countries that are always below 50, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and you have a few improvers as well. But even those improvements are not substantial enough to lead us to conclude that things have changed for the better."
Research by Transparency International also shows that populist or autocratic leaders usually install more corrupt systems in the countries they pledged to reform. U.S. President Donald Trump is asking for a review of America's methods for interrogating terror suspects, according to a draft executive order obtained by the news agency Associated Press. While explicitly rejecting torture, it contemplates harsh interrogation methods and the possible reopening of CIA secret prisons outside the United States. It also reverses former President Barack Obama's commitment to close down the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. At least 28 people died in a bomb attack near the entrance of a hotel in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, on Wednesday morning. Another 43 were injured in the attack claimed by the jihadist militia Al-Shabaab. Considering the tight security measures in place around the hotel, the way the attack was carried out has raised grave suspicions, says DW correspondent in Somalia, Isnina Jelle.
Maybe this is an inside job because four militias entered the hotel, and after 40 minutes, the second blast happened. So basically, as they're trying to put security very tight, it seems there's an inside job that is taking place.
Police say at least four people have been killed in three attacks by suicide bombers in Nigeria's Maiduguri, capital of the northeastern state of Borno. Two of the attacks were carried out by teenage female suicide bombers. Maiduguri is the birthplace of the Boko Haram Islamic insurgency. Burundi's government has started releasing scores of prisoners, including some accused of endangering state security. Following a clemency order issued by President Pierre Nkurunziza, a total of 2,500 prisoners are expected to be released. According to official information, among those who will be freed are 58 members of the opposition MSD party. Many of those due to be released had been sentenced to jail terms of less than 5 years and had served most of their terms. Gambia's new president, Adama Barrow, is set to return to his country on Thursday. An aide confirmed to news agencies on Wednesday that Barrow was preparing to head home from Senegal, where he was sworn into office last week. Barrow fled Gambia in mid-January when ex-leader Yahya Jammeh refused to step down and hand over power after losing elections. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Christina Kripal.
I'm Eunice Wanjiru. The government of Cameroon has imposed an internet blackout to stop people from the English-speaking zones of the country from using social media to mobilize people to call for either secession or the creation of a federal state. This has paralyzed communication and halted online money transactions and payments. The government is also sending SMS messages threatening to arrest people who use social media to propagate what it calls anti-state messages. Moki Kinzeka reports from Bamenda.
34-year-old Ngoran Ephraim says he and his seven workers have been out of business. Their cafe provides internet services to students and researchers at Commercial Avenue in Bamenda, Cameroon's northwestern region. Internet users in the affected parts of the country found out they could no longer communicate and disseminate information, particularly on social media. No prior notice had been given by the government before the internet blackout, according to Ephraim.
It's just unbearable. Students have not been able to carry on with their research works. Banks and any institutions, financial institutions that deal with money transactions, have not been able to carry on. People who used to rely solely on the internet to keep bread on their table have not been able to work, which means that the youth who are actively involved in this sector have gradually been laid off from their jobs. It's really terrible.
The internet has largely been used as a tool to mobilize people for mass protests, which have been characterized by ghost towns. Cameroon's Minister of Post and Telecommunication, Libom Lilikeng, says they ordered internet providers to suspend their services due to flaring protests in the region.
Be informed that when someone sends you information and asks you to share it, you will be called upon to justify. Cameroonians think they can hide. We're reminding them that there are laws regulating the sector, so that when they're called upon to explain, they cannot say they didn't know. It's a reminder, not a threat.
Cameroon's current challenges stem back to its pre-independence history, when it was formed from a region that was colonized by the British, with the region run by the French. Its government, education, and legal systems are dominated by the larger French-speaking region.
Moki Kinzeka with that report. So Ole, with the internet being down, do we even have anything on social media on that?
Yes, there's actually a lot of people discussing this on Twitter, at least. And Francis Nizuku said that, please, sent a call out that says, please retweet this to support the campaign to hashtag bring back our internet. And El Citoyen, also from Cameroon, wrote that the internet blackout is a violation of human rights. So there's obviously a lot of people very angry about the situation in Cameroon.
And I hope we'll come back to that later.
We will, yes.
Here in Germany, there's been something of a political bombshell. Sigmar Gabriel, the leader of Germany's second biggest party, the Social Democrats, is not going to run against Chancellor Angela Merkel in national elections in September, as had been widely expected. Instead, the party leadership endorsed Martin Schulz, the former president of the European Parliament in Brussels, as their flag bearer. He will also succeed Gabriel as the party's leader, and from Berlin, Daniel Pelt reports.
Sigmar Gabriel faced journalists with a mixture of sorrow and relief at SPD party headquarters on Tuesday evening. And he offered a clear explanation why Martin Schulz should be the party's candidate for Germany's top job instead of him.
The chairman of the Social Democrats must have the confidence that he can do the job himself, but he must also have the authority to propose the candidate who has the best chance of winning the election. That's why I proposed Martin Schulz. It was pretty much the obvious thing to do.
The choice of Schulz could boost the Social Democrats' chances in the upcoming polls in September. Gabriel has been dodged by low approval ratings throughout his time as party leader and cabinet minister. Martin Schulz, on the other hand, is one of the party's most popular politicians. A former bookseller who never went to university, he's admired by many Germans for his passionate political style and clear-cut rhetoric. After his endorsement by Gabriel, he promised to fight a hard battle.
Wir wollen einen Wahlkampf führen. We want to run an election campaign that will give the Social Democratic Party a clear mandate to lead this country. In these difficult times, our country needs clear leadership.
In diesen schwierigen Zeiten eine neue Führung.
But does Martin Schulz really have what it takes to unseat Chancellor Merkel? He has never played a leading role in German national politics. In 8 months' time, we'll know the answer.
Daniel Peltz.
And this has been another topic we've been seeing people discuss on social media. Callum Anderson was very impressed with Gabriel stepping down. He wrote that if I, quoting him, he said, "If I stand, I will fail, and so with me with the SPD," and said, "Much respect for Gabriel as he stands aside for Schulz." And Britke used a line that we are quite familiar with these days, and she said, "Martin Schulz will make the SPD great again."
Thanks, Ole. Dozens of people were killed today morning after two car bombs exploded outside the Daya Hotel in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. Gunfire was heard as fighters stormed the hotel, which is popular with politicians. A second blast shook the area shortly afterwards, injuring several journalists and others nearby. Before going on air, I spoke to DW's Jelle Isnina in Mogadishu, and I wanted to find out what the situation was like in the capital after the attack.
Currently, the situation is calm. Basically, after the incident, after an hour, the situation went back to normal. So many people have been wounded, around 51 people that have been rushed to hospital. And we've had also 20 people dead so far, 14 civilians, plus 7 soldiers and the 4 militias who were killed.
So these are official numbers of casualties that we have?
Currently, as communicated by the Minister, Abdulrazak Omar Mohamed, so far, 20 people dead, which included the 7 soldiers.
Al-Shabaab is fighting to overthrow the Western-backed government and regularly stages deadly attacks on state, military and civilian targets in the capital and elsewhere also in the war-torn country. What is the government doing about this?
The government has put cities all over the capital city, especially whereby attacks frequently happen. There are always checkpoints, the cars are always checked, but it all happens that maybe this is an inside job because 4 militias entered access to the hotel, and after 40 minutes, the second blast happened.
And we understand the presidential election has been postponed again. Do we know when the vote will take place?
The parliamentary sat yesterday, and the committee in charge of presidential election was voted yesterday, which by 11 from the upper house, from the lower house, which are the MPs, and 6 from the upper house, those are the senators, were selected yesterday. And today it was officially communicated that the presidential election will take place on 8th of February, whereby we are having 18 candidates, that includes 1 female.
Jelle Isnina in Mogadishu. Now, according to news agencies, the death toll has risen to 28. So, Ole, back to you. You promised us to give us more on Cameroon.
Yes, like I said, this is the main topic that people have been discussing on Twitter today and on our Facebook page, facebook.com/DW.Africa. And Sanyi Emmanuel Sanyi wrote that another day without internet in northwest and southwest Cameroon. These are regions in the Cameroon. And again, the hashtag is continuing to be bring back our internet. Elias Chinamore wrote that, so apparently Cameroon's president has blocked the internet. Another Jammeh is rising. Dictators have no place in Africa. And here he's referring to the recent political situation in the Gambia. But this is obviously a big problem for businesses. I mean, there's a lot of businesses in the area that need internet. So you have Kawala, who said, Marabanye wrote, no internet in the southwest. Does the government know how this affects our tech startups like Joku, AgriHub, and Feme? Do they even care? And that's a question. And this is something that's been going on for days. This is not a new thing. But Active Spaces, this is a place where you can go and rent space and work. They said that their office in Douala is open. And if you need internet connections, you can go to them.
Well, this seems to be quite difficult, but let's hope that they get internet quite soon.
Let's hope so.
Thanks, Ole. You're listening to Africa Link, coming to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn, Germany. I'm Eunice Njiro, and you're listening to Africa Link.
And I'm Oli Tangen Jr., bringing you your social media.
Coming up, we get to meet a 29-year-old African award-winning writer whose target audience is the whole world.
I can't call myself a writer if I am not doing any writing. And I also try to remember the impulse that brought me to writing, like way before.
And we will be discussing the social media anticipation to tonight's AFCON Games.
Thanks, Ole. But first, Transparency International released its 2016 Corruption Perceptions Index. It ranks 176 countries by their perceived levels of corruption in the public sector. The index ranges from 0 to 100, where the higher the figure, the cleaner the country, the lower the figure, the more corrupt the country is perceived to be. Now, a number of African countries are perceived as being corrupt, but has the African continent become more or less corrupt over the last 12 months, or is there no discernible trend? A question my colleague Mark Caldwell asked Samuel Kaninda, that's Transparency International's Africa Regional Advisor.
There's a mixed picture, but overall, the situation has not evolved substantially to the extent that the average score for Africa remains quite below average, which points to systemic corruption. So you have the likes of countries that are always below 50, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and a few others like Somalia still remaining at the bottom. And you have a few improvers as well, but even those improvements are not substantial enough to lead us to a point to conclude that things have changed substantially for the better.
Who are the improvers?
We have the likes of Cape Verde, which is a country that is consistently above average. We have Sao Tome and Principe in Central Africa that is also improved by 4 points. And Burkina Faso, which one can also understand, given the recent developments in the country, that they've gained a few points.
Broadly speaking, why did these improvements happen?
On the one hand, if you look at the likes of Cape Verde, Sao Tome and Principe, it's also the governance culture, if I would call it, or the systems, which for a number of years there's been a deliberate move on the side of leaders, especially when you look at Cape Verde, to strengthen governance institutions and to make them transparent. If you look at the side of Burkina Faso, which was also mentioned in one of the major improvers, one should put it in the context of also the work done by citizens and civil society. If you would recall with the ousting of the president following the uprisings of citizens in October 2014, then came a transitional authority for a year that led the country into the first democratic elections in decades. A new law on anti-corruption was passed in Burkina Faso, so there's been an expression of political will on the side of the leadership of the country.
Which African countries slipped down the table, became more corrupt?
One could make a distinction. You have some that the likes of Somalia, Angola and the Congo, DRC, that are still ranking quite low. But one surprise that came was also Ghana that lost a few points. Ghana is known as a democratic country. That a recent example is the elections that we had where President John Mahama Dramani lost and the new president came to power without any bloodshed or any unrest, civil unrest in the country. But then one would understand as well that one of the major themes in these elections were the fight against corruption, because people felt that increasingly the government that was there was no longer demonstrating commitment or working really for the benefit of citizens in the country.
Samuel Kaninda is Transparency International's Regional Advisor for Africa.
Yeah, that's another big topic today. And Eunice, it's these reports come out all the time and people react to them. And Charles Makoyenzoka from Tanzania wrote, African leaders need transparency, accountability and a high respect for public resources. And Andre Skut, who lives in the U.S., wrote that, but I heard the U.N., China, Africa, America and Europe are investing millions, even billions in Africa. Is any of this money going to combat corruption? I mean, this corruption is a constant topic, and it's really doesn't seem to be improving. Maybe baby steps.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
On the spot.
On the spot this week, we meet a 29-year-old who has achieved what many writers would dream of. Okwiri Oduor from Kenya won the Kane Prize for African Writing in 2014 for her short story called My Father's Head, and has not stopped writing ever since. Africa Link caught up with Oduor in the city of Cologne, where her winning piece was read for the first time in the German language. And as Zipporah Nyambura reports, she sees herself as a writer with not just one identity. She hopes to attract readers from any part of the world. Here's Zipporah Nyambura with her report.
Many readers agree that My Father's Head cannot be summed up as just another African story. Simbi, the narrator, tries to remember and draw what her father looked like, but cannot remember his features. In the end, she summons her father back so she can remember, but then he does not leave, and she is forced to face all the memories she has of him and her childhood. It's a story that transits through the various themes of religion, death, memory, and heritage in Kenya. But the author, Okwiri Oduor, refuses to be defined by just one identity as an African writer.
I'm an African writer, and then what next? I'm interested in the fullness of the human experience, you know, like creating characters that are dynamic, that are real people, that have weaknesses and that are have strengths, and, you know, the whole conversation about being an African writer and, you know, what kinds of themes you're working with and people, it brings other conversations as well. Like, you know, is someone writing the so-called poverty porn, but or, you know, and so on and so forth. But I think these are very lazy ways of looking at writing and literature.
It has been 3 years since she won the prize, a milestone in her career. A win that came with a prize of 10,000 euros. Aside from the acclaim, winning gave Oduor some time to reflect and focus on just writing.
I can't call myself a writer if I am not doing any writing. And I also try to remember the impulse that brought me to writing, like way before any MFA program, way before any Kane Prize, way before any story was published, I was writing.
Oduor started writing when she was 7 years old. At 24, her novella, The Dream Chasers, was highly commended in the 2012 Commonwealth Book Prize. She has also been named one of Africa's writers aged under 40 with potential to define trends in African literature with her story Ragdoll. She is advising young African writers to start writing even before they focus on winning any prizes.
Shouldn't pay too much attention to like writing schools. Writing schools, you know, MFA programs, residences, you know, all those things are, you know, necessary and good and, you know, all of that, but they do not make you. You have to be a writer before all those things.
At the moment, her focus is on her master's studies in creative writing in the US and her first novel, which, like her previous work, promises to touch on the most volatile issues of love, loss, and belonging.
A report by Zipporah Nyambura.
Living Planet Africa.
Renewable energy could transform the life of millions of people who still do not have any access to electricity at all in the African continent. In Senegal, for example, only half the population of 40 million has access to power. To illustrate the realities of living without light, 54 artists, one from each country on the African continent, have been brought together in an art exhibition called Lumière de Afrique, Light from Africa. Curated by African Artists for Development, the exhibition combines art, development, and climate protection. Emmanuel Lande in Dakar reports.
The gardens of the Ifor Museum of African Arts in central Dakar are dimly lit despite the setting sun, a nod to the exhibition taking place in the Senegalese capital. A large sphere of cables with light bulbs protruding from each loose wire is positioned near the entrance. It's the first indication we're at an environmental art show. Lumière d'Afrique, Light of Africa, is an exhibition thought up by Gervain Leridon from the Paris-based NGO African Artists for Development. She says 54 artists from each country of the continent were asked to illustrate their interpretation of the theme, Access to Energy in Africa.
L'énergie, c'est loin d'être neutre. L'énergie, c'est la lumière. Cela permet donc d'aller à l'école.
Energy is far from being neutral. Energy is the light that allows one to go to school. It allows one to teach. It allows one to study. Thus, it allows one to radically change the rules of tomorrow's world and allowing everyone to place that boundary where they wish and not where it's imposed.
In a dark, curtained-off room on the sidelines of the exhibition, the videos of the 54 artists are projected, each one with a message. Take a listen to artists from Nigeria.
My name is Emeka Okereke, and I'm a Nigerian visual artist. In this project, Lumière d'Afrique, I want to address one question. How can there be darkness and no light in a continent where the sun never ceases to shine?
According to the Senegalese Ministry of Energy, only 26% of the country's rural areas have access to electricity, compared to 89% in urban areas. That's due mostly to access and cost. Abdou Ndour works at the NGO Ender Energy in Dakar. According to him, the further away you are from the national power lines and the fewer people there are in your community, the less chance you are of getting your village hooked up to the grid. It's not financially profitable.
Mais imaginez un village de, disons, 100-200 personnes.
Imagine a village of 100 to 200 people that's 20 kilometers or 12 miles away from the grid and you want to install the network to electrify it, it's going to cost too much. What the village will pay in 10 years of electricity bills will not cover the cost of putting the power line and the equipment in place. That is why it is said that rural electrification is not financially profitable.
Back at the exhibition, hopes are high that access to energy will become a reality for all parts of the continent. Soli Cisse, a Senegalese artist, is showing a collage entitled The Future. On a blue background, faces and silhouettes are brought to life in a yellow light.
I am of the generation that has always lived with electricity. But my father comes from a village where there is no electricity. We need solar energy, and we're at a time where we must develop these sources of energy. We have it in abundance, so we just have to exploit it.
A call to action from the art world for faster, more efficient development in Africa and to bring electricity to those that will boost the growth of the continent.
Emmanuel Londe reporting. Ole.
Please.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, as you know, Eunice, tonight is the AFCON. We have some games coming and we have Uganda will be playing Mali and Ghana will be taking on Egypt. This is the last of the group stages. And Ghana has clinched a place in the next round with 6 points. But depending on the result, Egypt or Mali could make it to the knockout rounds. And we asked for predictions and Julius Odeng from Uganda says that Ghana is going to draw. And that Ghana will draw with Egypt and Mali will beat Uganda. And wow, a Uganda not pulling for his own team to win. But there has been a lot of support for the Cranes in the AFCON because they've been gone for almost four decades. And Jose Mutuk said tonight's win, if they would win tonight, it would definitely send a message that across Africa that we will be back, hashtag Uganda Cranes. And there is some support for the Ghana team as well. And Kevin Osei wrote that we need a first place in the group tonight.
I believe Ghana is getting more support heading to their match against the seven-time champions, Egypt, isn't it?
They are. And Joseph Kwame, he's a bit nervous. He says, I'm more scared when the Black Stars are playing the North African countries because they are faster on the ball. And just a quick shout out to Kevin Dupereau, one of our listeners in Canada, who wrote a congratulations to us on Facebook and listens to us every morning on his commute to work. So thank you, Kevin.
Thanks a lot also to all our listeners and all who contributed on our Facebook page. Do visit our website, that's dw.africa.com/Africa, and our webpage, DW Africa. For me, Eunice Wanjiru, have a great day.
And I'm Ole Tangen Jr. Bye for now.